Get some gains.
Recently, I came upon an article from a outlet called Give Me Sport, and I'll drop the link in so you can read it. And it was all about, you know, Mike Tyson's diet and training regime during his boxing prime. And, you know, I had to take a look. And what I want to do too is, you know, there's obviously your initial reaction, and I wanted to kind of process it for 24 hours, come back to it, chew on it. And a lot of what happens when you look back at older training plans, just like anything, you know, you tend to discount it, or you say, oh, it's too simple or archaic, outdated, there's no modern methods here. But then you have to like step back and like, oh wait, this was the youngest heavyweight champion of all time. This was who many believe in his prime was the perfect fighter. And, you know, many will say now, you know, Mike Tyson was one of the more overrated fighters ever. I'll disagree, just in the sense that when he was in his prime, when he had Customato, Teddy Atlas was his trainer at one point before they had that fallout. When he had the right trainers giving him the discipline and the structure he needed to thrive, especially, again, this was a teenager. You know what I'm saying? Like, and that's part of what had to be looked at too. This was Mike Tyson as a teenager, what he did. His recent comeback, by the way, in fighting Roy Jones Jr., he went right back to the same calisthenics routine, a lot of the same stuff he used to do. You saw, like, he went from like 300 pounds to fighting weight. You know, it's a different look, weight at in his 50s, but like, it's still like, it's incredible. You saw some of the speed. We last year at one point at thedailybj.com, we worked on one of the combinations that Mike Tyson shared on social, getting ready for that fight, and that was a lot of fun. But you still saw like this he still had that speed and power, that knockout power will be with him till he dies. And but you know what, he has the power, but the speed wasn't there. When he went to prison and came out, in his own words, I listened to his podcast as well. He's got a really interesting podcast. And he said, I wasn't the same fighter. Many believe he peaked in 86 when he fought Spinks. It was like the perfect fight. You know, Spinks beat Muhammad Ali. Spinks may not have been at his peak, but he was a seasoned heavyweight. And Tyson took him out with a body shot in the first round. He beat him. If you look at the footage, he had Spinks shook in just the stare down. I mean, Spinks did not want to be there. It was very clear. And that was part of the aura of Mike Tyson. But because he was an undersized heavyweight, 5'10", you know, 215 to 220 based on, you know, the fight, he was always kind of, that was his like ideal fighting weight. And, you know, you're fighting guys 6'5", 250, you know, that was like right before heavyweights just got like huge. And then, you know, no one's ever really talked about, at least as far as I've seen, like, you know, I guess when you get to like 6'5", 6'6", and 250 plus, I mean, there used to be super heavyweight, like Butterbean, but, you know, that just, it's hard to, because, you know, like between like 165 and 180, different classes, right? But 50 plus pounds and you're fighting the same people, you know, that's definitely up for conversation. But because of that, didn't have very long arms. So the only way he could compete with these bigger, longer fighters is movement, speed, changing angles. And when we work on in our express workouts for December at thedailybj.com, we worked all jab in October. Again, we worked the basics all year, built up some really cool combinations. What did we do? You go right back to the basics again, and you do a refresh, and you tighten things up. You work that jab. And one thing I'll touch on too, I'm listening to Teddy Atlas, who was kind of co-trainer to Mike Tyson back in the day when he was at his best with Customato. He has a great analogy for the purpose of the jab when you're actually fighting, which is it puts bugs on the windshield of your opponent. Meaning when you're constantly putting that fist and that face in the eyes, you're blurring the vision. When you have a really dirty windshield, it's tough to navigate the road, especially at high speeds. And when you're fighting, this is at high speed. This is fast reaction stuff. So the jab is just muddying the waters of your opponent's vision and beyond setting up everything else that you do in a fight. But I thought that was a great analogy since we're just talking about Teddy Atlas. That one really, like, that was a great visual of what the jab can do from a specific purpose of just weakening your opponent's vision. But he needed that speed, and he got slow, and he got heavier when he came out of prison. He actually, in some cases, looked more impressive. Like, he got thicker, but that was not what Mike Tyson needed. Mike Tyson needed the speed because he was undersized. So that's why if you say he's overrated, he may have been overrated, quote unquote, coming out of prison, but that was not the same fighter. He didn't train the same way. He didn't have the same trainers, and he lost that speed. You know, and by the way, Ali lost that same speed when he went to prison. You know, Ali was in prison. Both Ali and Tyson were in prison for about 3 years and change during their primes for different reasons. But, and were never the same fighters. The difference is Ali was undoubtedly a smarter fighter. Ali changed his style, not only per opponent, but, you know, he changed his style in that second stage of his career because, you know, he knew he didn't have that same lightning speed. Still led with the jab. There wasn't as much dancing or footwork. So, but, you know, he was able to tailor his fighting style for the opponent. Ali had no business in the ring with a guy like George Foreman. But his intelligence and his stamina and everything else allowed him to knock out George Foreman. Not only, you think about, yeah, styles make fights and it's all about the opponent, but Joe Frazier, one of the best heavyweight fighters of all time, a guy that pushed Ali in one of the best trilogies ever, by the way, and I'm actually thinking about putting together a podcast after I put together a series of 30 fights in 30 days. My favorite 30 fights that I've seen over the years. You watch one a day, they'll almost all be accessible on YouTube as far as I know. Still kind of compiling the list, and then I can do kind of a synopsis on each fight. If you're interested, let me know. I'm curious, because again, that's something I'm actually really passionate to talk about. And, you know, it gets me excited. But where was I going with that? Let me just refresh here. So I'm thinking about doing that, but, you know, that trilogy, first of all, Frazier beat Ali in the first one. Ali had a decisive victory in the second. And then the third one, they both almost died. Frazier almost died after the first fight, but he dominated the first fight. I mean, it's just crazy. Like, it was like the perfect match of opponents. You know, a guy that would just always keep coming forward, and Frazier, who had that devastating left hook, and then Ali, who just had, you know, those really fast hands and really the jab. The jab just, like, he damaged Frazier's face so much with the jab over the course of the 15 rounds, 12 or 15, I forget, in that first one, that, you know, Frazier almost died from the first fight. But Ali wanted to quit in the corner in the third fight, the Thrill of Manila, where it was like 90 degrees. They're both older, not the same fighters, but perfectly, they both lost like the same amount of skill, right? Or speed or instincts. They had the instincts, but they lost that raw physicality, but they both lost the same amount. So it was an even match. And Ali wanted to quit in the corner. And then luckily for him, Frazier's corner threw the towel at that exact moment, like right before Ali was thinking about throwing in the towel. And Ali is quoted often as saying that was the time that, you know, I really felt like that was the closest to death I ever was in that fight. So, but George Foreman destroyed Joe Frazier. He knocked him down 6 times in 2 rounds, knocked him out cold. Frazier was like galloping, he was bouncing off of his knees. He destroyed him so bad. And that's why the rematch between Ali and Frazier was postponed, because no one thought, that Frazier was going to be so devastated by Foreman, but they thought, you know, Foreman was going to lose. But Foreman destroys Frazier, knocks him down 6 times. Ali finds the way to knock out Foreman. So it was intelligence. It was, you know, obviously the rope-a-dope. He had Foreman punch himself out. He got on Foreman's head. He also had almost like a metaphysical backing from the people of Zaire, where it was fought. You know, they would chant Ali Boumaye, Ali kill him. He had the whole, he felt the power of the audience and the whole country behind him. And he pulled off the impossible. He was a more intelligent fighter, even with diminished skills. With Tyson, you know, you end up seeing what happened is he reverted to bad habits, or because that speed wasn't there, he went to more mauling, brutal tactics. He didn't have the same conditioning either. We'll talk about this. One of the things that stuck out in this plan, the way he used to train, is there was a lot of cardio and conditioning. And that was one of the things that was crazy about Mike Tyson is so many of his initial fights were short fights. You know, he quick early round knockouts, and they're like, there's no way he's going to be able to maintain this power or speed in later rounds. And then he had a couple fights that went to decision in 10 rounds that he won, and he was still able. He had the legs in particular. Maybe it was the recumbent biking. You know, you would think what carry over to boxing, but his legs were there for him in late rounds in the first part of his career pre-prison. They weren't there for him in the second act. So that has to be considered as well. My buddy Tony Jeffries, the best boxing content on social media, you can check him out in all outlets. His YouTube channel is the best place to really get the stuff because it gets best catalog and it's more longer form. You can really learn stuff there, in my opinion. But he thinks too that, you know, his opinion, Tyson was, in his day, he was the best. Could a prime Tyson beat a prime Ali? Because Ali was a smarter fighter as he got older. Interesting. I don't know. That's another conversation. But Ali was 6'2 to 6'3, longer arms, this incredible jab. But Ali was Tyson and Frazier had similar styles in the sense that there was a lot of movement and they really were looking to set up round punches. You know, when you're a shorter fighter and you have shorter arms, it's tough to work those straights. Ali was a much better straight puncher. A lot of jabbing, worked in some cross. He had the ability to do some hooks and uppercuts, but it wasn't his main weapon. Tyson was all about hooks and uppercuts. He had a good jab. He had a great overhand right, but that was a short arm. So changing in angles, much the way Frazier did, a lot of head movement, would come forward, try to get inside, and then try to work that devastating left hook. You know, that's what's crazy about Tyson. Tyson had the same power in both hands, and he was just as good with hooks and uppercuts in both hands. So he would have been a dangerous fighter for Ali in his prime. I think, hands down, Ali wins as they're both later. As older fighters, Ali wins it hands down. In their early 20s, teens, that's maybe one of the best. That's the fight I think we all would want to see. But it's hard not to give Ali the edge because, in my opinion, Foreman would have destroyed Mike Tyson. Maybe not the young prime, but, man, Tyson struggled with those taller, bigger fighters, and Foreman's punching power was just legendary. But anyway, I wanted to share with you what I saw here, some takeaways. So let's talk first thing. You know, the diet. So consider, this is a teenager, and you hear, oh, he's eating 3,000 to 4,000 calories a day in three square meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then there were the snacks he would have. He was a lot of protein shakes. But he's a teenager, and he's training 10 hours a day. So what might sound like a ton of calories to the average person, like, you know, what's the, it's like 2,200 calories, the average diet for people, or the recommended daily intake of calories, which is like, what does that even mean? You got different genders, you've got different body sizes, different activity levels, you know, different levels of muscle mass, whatever. How can that be? Whatever. That's the average. So it sounds almost double the average, but this is a teenager training 10 hours a day and he's all muscle. So that was surprising. I thought, you know, you would think that would be, I don't know, like double, maybe 5,000 to 6,000 calories minimum. Like a lot of these, I think Michael Phelps was like, don't quote me on this, but I think some of the stuff I saw in his Olympic training, again, keep in mind, I guess, when you are in water, you burn more calories, especially cooler water. You deplete sugar faster, and your body has to actually work harder to keep you warm because of being in cooler water. So it just, your calorie burn is accelerated, which means you need more water coming in, more calories coming in because of that water training. But, you know, I think like 6,000 to 10,000 calories for Michael Phelps and, you know, that type of thing. So that was interesting. But you take that, and then you also look at, okay, what were the meals? Breakfast was oatmeal, milk, and a vitamin supplement. Then he had lunch was chicken breast, rice, and orange juice. And then dinner was steak, pasta, and orange juice again. And then again, he would supplement with, you know, if he had to snack, there were protein shakes. So, if we're talking a couple scoops of protein powder, that's a couple hundred calories. But just giving you enough stuff to recover for all those, you know, the 10 hours of training was broken up into 6 training sessions. So, you know, he had to sneak some stuff in there. Now, it's interesting too, because there was a point in I got so afraid of carbohydrate because when I was a teenager, I would drink at least 1 tall glass of milk and juice and orange juice at every meal. And sometimes I would double up on that. And I ate way too much bread. I had way too many liquid calories. So as I often have done in my life, I went to the other extreme and I just eliminated liquid calories, period. But I mean, today, and a lot of this is too, when I was fatter, I was more insulin resistant. That means that my body was not properly able to handle incoming carbohydrate. And it was more likely to, instead of use it for fuel, store it as fat. This is where being lean is the gift that keeps on giving. As I've gotten in better shape over the years, without shocking my body and slowly whittling down the body fat and then slowly adding muscle mass and, you know, body recomposition, staying the same weight, but improving your body composition by whittling away at the fat and slowly sculpting, adding muscle to the body. You know, now my carb tolerance is way higher, even at 39. So, you know, I try to have at least 1 or 2 cups. If I make my Tropical Gain Shake, I always have a cup of orange juice with that. And then sometimes at night before dinner, I'll have a cup of orange juice because I tend to do some activity before dinner now. And the question is why? Well, it's not that you say, well, what about the sugar? Well, yeah. So someone who has a lot of body fat, particularly belly fat, and not a lot of muscle, yeah. I guess I'm not recommending a lot of orange juice or orange juice in general. There's other ways to get vitamin C, but the thing about it is a cup of orange juice gets you 100% of the vitamin C you need each day. 100%. Vitamin C is one of the most important things you can put into your body to recover, to handle oxidative stress, all right? So a couple glasses of orange juice for someone who's highly active a day, it's one of the best things you can do for recovery. It's old school, but, you know, and my whole thing is too, if you can get it in a liquid or a food, probably better than taking it in pill form. They even said collagen supplements, the jury is kind of out. I think I shared this a couple months ago or something on social, but Precision Nutrition, you can check them out, precisionnutrition.com. They did a basically review of like, is collagen effective? And essentially what they said is not really, especially if it's not coming with vitamin C. Vitamin C apparently helps you better absorb the collagen. And in general, get your collagen from natural sources. Bone broth. You know, that's I'm such a big fan of soups and stews. You can use organic chicken or beef bone broth to make these stews. And now you're giving your body natural collagen. And by the way, I'm one of those like sick motherfuckers. I like to eat the cartilage on bones. I don't have any proof whether or not that helps. It might be pure bro science, but I just look at it as, okay, it's cartilage on this bone. It can't hurt my cartilage or my general lack of it, at least on my knees. So I just thought that was interesting. And again, he's having, you know, it's a classic like protein starch meal plan. You know, and you could argue there's probably could have used some more healthy fats in the mix there. I don't know what was in the oatmeal. Maybe threw some peanut butter in there, whatever else. But the only thing you could really question there is the overall fat intake and the mix of healthy fats. omega-3, stuff like that. But I thought that was interesting. But then again, like, you know, what people often overlook, part of why I identify with Mike Tyson so much, he was a fat kid who got bullied, who became the baddest man on the planet. And he was a fat kid. Mike Tyson was basically an endomorph who, through training and nutrition and discipline, morphed himself into what appeared to be a mesomorph. So he was an endomeso, meaning, by the way, Mike Tyson also recently was 300 plus pounds. This is a guy that can get really fat if he abandons the discipline of his diet and training. And but also a guy that can quickly, even in his 50s, get down to fighting weight and look like a bad dude in his 50s and still move in ways that the average person couldn't even dream of. He may not be prime Iron Mike in 86, but he is a specimen in his 50s just by going back to that same plan from 300 plus pounds, depressed, drugs, all that stuff, alcohol. So that's one of those things. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you have people that are ectomorphs, meaning that they're very lean, gangly, thin, couldn't put on a pound if their life depended on, especially in their youth or if they're active, but through disciplined training and diet can become ectomeso. Meso, like true meso, means like this dude or dudette is just like gifted. They're lean naturally and muscular naturally. And for them to deviate either way, to lose muscle or to gain fat, is just difficult. And it's going to take a long time. They have to get old, and they have to just really do damage to their body long term. That's true meso. So it's funny. You would think this guy would need at least twice the calories, but no. And it's like when I get to the training component, like this sounds like way too much cardio. Isn't it going to eat your muscle mass? How could someone that muscular be doing this much cardio? It's counter to all the things you thought you knew about training, or the way that people, you know, purport, like if you run or do cardio, you'll lose all your muscle mass. Well, when we get to his training, I beg to differ. And he does too, based on what was done. So this is why it's one of those things too, like, well, BJ, what's your diet? Well, look, I was an endo. I was a fat kid. I can get huge. If I want to, I can eat 6 to 8 meals a day and get to 275, 300 pounds. Especially now, like I'm a man. I'm a man! So I could really get huge if I wanted to, but I don't want to. I don't want to go back to that life. But I could get huge if I wanted to. All right? So for me, I'm able, because of building muscle isn't a challenge for me. And I can in some cases do it in a deficit. But being lean is really tough. So for me, I have to almost underfeed myself to find the look I'm going for. All right. And then some of you are the exact opposite, and you're gonna have to overfeed yourself. And there's both are stresses, by the way. And this is a lifelong journey of finding what that looks like. But people forget he was a fat kid that used to get picked on. So that you take that 3,000 to 4,000 calories a day from 10 hours of training in your teens, and you're like, okay, that makes sense. And now it makes sense, like, why he got so fat. And I saw some a couple weeks ago, I saw, you know, poor Zion, man. I wish this young man well. But he got injured again, and he's having, you know, I think it was a foot or something. But there was footage of him that was released, and on Inside the NBA with, you know, Shaq, Ernie, Barkley, and Kenny Smith. Barkley made a joke when they saw the footage. He looks like him and Shaq in their current day had a baby, and he looks heavy, you know, and he was doing like some shuffling and some sprinting, and he went over to the sideline and was like, you could just tell his feet, he's having trouble, like, and I know he's had troubles with shoes in the past. Remember they came out, his shoe like popped off. This guy's so powerful. I mean, he is one of the most powerful people I think we've ever seen, but his poor body does not have the stability to handle the power. And it just means that until someone gets him, has an honest conversation about food with this man, and gives him some, you know, again, not give him a complex about it, but give him some, you know, some leadership and some guidance about taking control of his diet, because of how injury prone he's going to be with in general with that amount of horsepower in your body. But then you add excess weight to it that he doesn't need on his body, and you're playing a sport like basketball where, man, like every jump, even with an extra 5 to 10 pounds, takes a toll. 82 game season, not counting preseason, off-season work, and then if they make the playoffs, I mean, that's a whole other story. And he's 20, in his early 20s now, and the amount of injuries happening. Shout out to the Boones. But Jason Boone, professional basketball player in Europe, asked me, because I shared the clip with him, and he said, what would you do with Zion? What would be one of the things you would do? And I said, honestly, I am old school. I like to keep things simple. When I see someone with poor lower body stability, all right, prone to lower body injuries, barefoot lunging. Start with a minute. Build up to two. If I could get him up to, 20 to 30 minutes of continuous stepping up and lunging barefoot, I believe that would transform him. That would change his body. And that would give him some real resilience out there on the court. But you just see it and it's like, wow, there's so much power there, but there's no stability. And he was like, you could tell his feet were hurting, or like he had trouble like getting the proper contact with his feet on the floor during the drills. Or again, like he just was so deconditioned and hadn't done much. And then you come back with 20 plus pounds of weight on your body. And it's just like, it's crazy. But Zion's kind of another example of that body type. That's a dude that can get huge if he doesn't keep his diet and training in check. But he's also a guy that can look like the ultimate man when he's got the right routine in place, just like Tyson. So, you know, I just wanted to touch on that as a parallel. But, I guess supplement-wise, he was taking, obviously protein powders, creatine. Creatine is the supplement you want to take for, if you think about your energy systems, you've got your phosphagen energy system. That's the ATP PC. PC is phosphocreatine. And that's going to be the energy system you use, maximal efforts, sprinting, typically 10 to 20 seconds or less. Most would say 5 to 8 seconds, depending on the higher end athlete. But what creatine supplementation does is it gives you extra energy for that energy system. So it's very beneficial for the strength power athlete. But how much does it help someone on the more endurance stamina side of things? Probably not so much. Now, to that end, he also took beta-alanine. And beta-alanine, by the way, in terms of like popular culture, it's relatively new. Like it just started coming out about 5 to 10 years ago as like something you would find in commercial supplements. So this is crazy that they were using it all the way back then. But beta-alanine is kind of like the creatine for longer duration work periods. And what it helps you do, it helps buffer acidosis, or the acidity that happens in the muscles from extended duration work. You know, the burning you feel in your muscles, that developing of lactate, it's acid, hydrogen ions that are basically starting to, once they accumulate, you feel a lot of burning in your muscles, and it makes it so muscles have a hard time firing because of all the acid. Beta-alanine helps buffer that, so you can actually work longer before that acidosis takes over and it helps you kind of terminate a set. Caffeine. You know, the real advantage of caffeine, especially if you're underfed, is what happens when you're underfed and you're doing a lot of activity. You don't have the energy. But caffeine is a drug. It's a stimulant that can give you that energy even when you're underfed and overtrained. So, 6 sessions a day. So, you know, that's why I tend to have higher caffeine intakes on during weekdays. Obviously, I'm working, I'm training, and I'm highly active. And, so I'll have my couple cups of coffee in the morning. And on days, especially like Wednesday in particular, Tuesday or Wednesday, when, that's when the fatigue starts to accumulate, I'll use that afternoon caffeine hit, to help me propel myself forward. And then what I try to do is taper off on the weekends when I'm treating myself to higher calories. And I'll still, actually, I try to do a lot of good training on the weekends too to take advantage of the calories. but I try to limit caffeine so I don't lose tolerance. And, you know, you don't want to have too much caffeine. It's just not something, you know, you don't want to depend on it, but use it to help you when you need it. And that's typically when you're strategically underfed and doing a lot of activity. So, and then vitamin D, you know, and again, even what people say is there's no substitute for the vitamin D from sun, but vitamin D supplementation is beneficial to people living in colder northern climates. And vitamin D is very important for metabolism. You know, there's something magical that people don't just get leaner in the summer because of the fact that they're quote unquote more active. And I've talked about this anecdotally with other trainers, like when my body is under the sun, that's when I'm most lean. If my body gets consistent sun exposure, all other things being equal, that's when I'm most lean. And, you know, that's obviously vitamin D. So, you know, that was interesting too, but not a lot of supplements, especially considering how much training he was doing. This is all basic, safe stuff. Now let's talk about his training. Let me refresh quick. If there's any, we've got members of the dailybj.com get access to the live version of this podcast. They also, we did an hour before just on my latest training template, ATLR, Activation, Thunder, Lightning, Rain. It's exclusive stuff. It's you know, I think it's worth the investment. Roberto asks, what about collagen peptides? You know, so the overall take on this was probably not worth your money if your budget is tight, but if you can fit it in, and for me, you know, this is my job, it's my career, it's my lifestyle. Even if it doesn't work, it's not going to hurt. So I might as well take it, because, you know, sometimes different studies come out that say, oh, no, it does work. So, but again, my biggest takeaway from that was the claims with it are not only are possibly exaggerated, and it's not as effective as the natural source, and it's not as effective without vitamin C with it. So that's why in my Tropical Gains shake, you know, I use orange juice in that, and then when I add the collagen. So technically, if you're going to use powder, you want vitamin C to come with it. And again, like I actually get some of these, I think it's Uncle Matt's. There's like fortified brands of orange juice. One of them is like Ultimate Immunity, has like elderberry, and this has 300% of vitamin C daily value. And I'm just telling you right now, like the more active you are, 100% of your daily value, maybe if you're like, you have a desk job. The more active you are, the greater your vitamin C needs. And I remember like one of the classic old school trainers, Charles Staley, and he's the guy, by the way, EDT, he popularized escalating density training. It's basically that concept where you say, I'm going to work for 10 minutes and I'm going to pick two movements, for example. And he called them PR zones, personal record zones. And I'm going to do 5 reps of each using a load that I can maybe do 10 reps with. And I'm going to do as many rounds of those two moves as possible in 10 minutes and work continuously. He was a huge fan of vitamin C tablet supplementation at night. So, but again, this is where, again, you know, people say, well, BJ, it's juice, it's sugar. Well, A, it's delicious, and I like to get it with a lot of pulp. Oh, I love it with pulp. By the way, the other Uncle Matt's one, by the way, it's expensive orange juice. It's like $8 for the full bottle. So you can just get a good organic juice for $3 or $4. But if you can treat yourself, like this one has turmeric, other ingredients in it that have benefits, some probiotics, I think, in one of them, which is great for digestive health. So it's just like a super juice. But the BJ today is a different BJ than I was when I was a kid. And by the way, I drank a lot of juice in my teens and I recovered great. And it wasn't just because I was a teen. I got a shit ton of vitamin C when I was an athlete. So again, I'm not saying drink a liter of juice, but a cup or two of orange juice for an active, lean, muscular individual every day might be one of the best things you can do for recovery. And it's just interesting that that's what was a staple in his diet. So here was the 10 hours of training he would do leading up until a fight. So 6 sessions in a day, early morning, noon, mid-afternoon, early evening, after dinner, and late evening. And part of what was so interesting about this too is, you know, Mike Tyson had a troubled childhood. He was in and out of juvenile detention, prison. And, you know, he's from Brownsville, man. It's a tough place to live. Tough place to live. I mean, you got to be a real tough individual to make it out of Brownsville. I have never been there, but I'm just, from what I've heard and all the documentaries and stories I've heard, I've been to Brooklyn before, Bushwick. My wife has some friends that live there. Like a lot of places in New York, it's become gentrified and it's much safer than it was in the 80s and 90s. But you're just a tough individual. It's a tough place. But, you know, one of the best things for, what do we know? Why are after school programs so effective? Why are sports so effective? You keep kids busy. Because what happens when kids get bored? They fuck around. So part of me wonders, you know, Custom Motto is an old school genius trainer, created his own system of fighting, had, you know, created real champions that people will remember forever. And I wonder how much of that was not just to condition, but just to keep him busy and out of trouble. I guess we'll never know. He's long passed away, but long since passed. But that's the first thing I thought of. Why that probably was the key for Tyson is you got to keep him real busy with training. Because especially, you know, I mean, can you imagine being the heavyweight champ, the most intimidating, powerful person on the planet at 19 years old, suddenly accessing millions of dollars, women all over you, everybody wanting a piece, and temptation is everywhere, right? And then you lose the trainers that kept you busy and kept you focused and kept you disciplined, kept you accountable. And then you put all these people around you that are yes men, yes women, that enable. And I mean, it's a recipe for disaster. I thank God I didn't ever find myself in that situation. Because, I mean, if I think about who I was when I was 19, I don't want to get into all of this, but I was lucky because I did have run-ins with the law. Because, you know, I was picked on a lot. I was bullied in my home. I was bullied at school. I became a bully. And, you know, this is what happens when you bully. You create bullies. And, you know, I never really got into fist fights, but I got into some physical altercations. I made some stupid choices. There was an incident of vandalism. I'm not proud of any of this, by the way, but I got lucky in the sense that at least that vandalism incident, which was basically, I mean, look, it is what it is. We did like toilet papering and, you know, we pranked one of our principal's homes, but we did it with someone who was connected and a legend at the school. And that's why we didn't get into true legal trouble. There were other incidents too, I don't have to get into, but you know, it's just, this is what happens when you live in environments with a lot of aggression, man. You make people caged beasts. And all they know is that people lash out at you. That's what you know. So, you know, it's part of, because I've worn like Mike Tyson gear in the past and people will say, he's a rapist. Well, you know what? I wasn't in that room. Mike Tyson tends to be an open book. He talks about how horrible he was or what things he did in the past. And he's a man who has demonstrated, in my mind, true contrition for past problems. But that seems to be the one thing he says he wasn't guilty of, you know, but that he's okay with it because of the things he did do that were wrong. I don't know. But all we can do in this life is hope that we don't get judged for the worst things we've done. You know, as a trainer, you know, I've been doing this a long time. I try to share the best stuff I can. Some things are better than others. I've also gotten much better at what I do over the years. My technique and form is way better than it used to be. So if you judge me by the way I used to do squats or push-ups or pull-ups even 5 years ago, you know, you might not think I'm a good trainer compared to the way I do it now. So I hope you judge me by my full body of work. You know, there are ebbs and flows to all of this. We all make mistakes. You know, and that's why for me, one of the things that I'm most proud of in my career is that my book, Your Body is Your Barbell, it didn't have the commercial success I had hoped for, but man, it's like, it became like a cult classic among prisoners. And that was like, to me, wow, this is, then you know what, this was a good piece of work. This is a timeless book because they are in a cell. They are in a situation where society has given up on them or threw them away. Some are there wrongfully, some are there rightfully. But, you know, this society, at least American society, does not know how to rehabilitate. You look at the recidivism rates in prison. Our criminal justice system is just, I mean, I'm not an expert in it, but I don't think you need to be to admit it needs serious work. It needs an overhaul. But fitness is something that many prisoners or inmates have lettered, messaged me over the years. The book literally helped them get through the toughest time in their life when society gave up on them. And in some cases, some of them came out and became trainers. It gave them a true path to rehabilitation because, you know, one thing Tyson talked about in prison, it was one of the few times in his life where he was most comfortable because he knew that life. He grew up in that system before he found success in boxing. And those 3 years, he knew what to do, but it was actually being out in society where you can't trust anyone and, you know, that he found more problems. But it's fascinating. There was a structure there that he could depend on and rely upon that he was comfortable with. And much like he did with this intensive training nutrition plan. So I share this with you because, you know, I think we have to be mindful of, you know, we're all going to make mistakes in our youth. And some of us are not lucky enough to be able to do it behind the scenes or not be judged about it forever because they weren't public figures. And then some of us weren't. I mean, I was lucky to go to a school that had people that maybe looked out for me with some of the mistakes I made. I mean, I was almost expelled from school for physical altercations. People that picked on me, but that pushed me to a limit where I snapped. You know, and, you know, I'm not happy about that. I've worked really hard to try to, you know, one of the things interesting with if you're prone to rage, you know, it's one of those things. Rage is just a physical demonstration of pain. You're in pain. No one like wants to rage. Maybe besides a bull because they got so much fucking testosterone, man. Bulls are like truly rageful creatures. You can't do anything about it. So much testosterone, but it's just pain. So one thing I've kind of come to terms with, when I feel pain, I can go two ways. I can go the rage route, or I can just be sad and maybe cry and just get it out. And, you know, you could look at that as weakness, but no, this is me taking control because I don't want to rage. Raging doesn't do me good. It's exhausting. It makes me feel like shit. I don't want to be rageful. You know, it's a powerful thing and people think, oh, it makes you a man. But to me, I've finally become a man at this age in life because I have a way to channel my pain. If someone, insults me or criticizes me, I don't want to go the rage route. And, you know, that's part of what, why we're finally learning the detrimental effects of social media. And then I was, you know, my work with Men's Health, I got in front of millions of people and I may have been, from a craft professional standpoint, I was ready for that role mentally, emotionally, psychologically. I was not ready to get in front of that many people and deal with that much criticism on a daily basis. It made me hate people. It made me so cynical. It brought out all my worst traits, you know, but at the same time, when people criticize me or belittle me or insult me, because, you know, I just don't want to be fucked with. I don't fuck with you. Why are you fucking with me? I'm just trying to share good stuff. So, but I am the type, you know, I am in the fight or flight, I am fight. And, you know, it just is what it is. That's in me. That's part of the reason I'm here today, because as I've alluded to many times before, I have a father that came from a slum in North Africa. He was a fighter. He may not have boxed in the ring, and the abuse I suffered at his hands was a shell of what he suffered as a kid in his lifestyle. But it does make us who we are. And part of the maturity process, the aging process, as we find different ways to channel that pain so it doesn't negatively affect other people. And you know what? Unlike like rage gives you instant relief, but then it gives you guilt and it makes you like hate yourself. Crying is some of the best. I feel great afterwards. I do. It's a great release. I let out all that. It's a way to slowly and more lastingly let out steam. I digress. But you know, again, that's why I think we got to be mindful of judging people too much. All right. So the morning got underway with 3 to 5 mile run. Then he did 3 rounds of calisthenics. I'll talk about the calisthenics next. And 10 rounds of sparring during the noon. By the way, that's probably more than any of us have ever done in a single day. Like, just because I do at least 6 miles a day now in 2 separate sessions with a dog walk. And a mix of walking and running, but mostly walking. And I mean, that's a lot of walking. Like that's a type of walking that I have to recover from. I know it sounds crazy, but no, it's a lot of mileage. So, but he's starting his day with a run like that, then doing 3 rounds of body weight circuits, and then 10 rounds of sparring. If you ever sparred, by the way, Jordan Roberts and JR asked me recently, did you ever do any sparring? And what I used to do with Tony Jeffries when we used to train together once a week in Santa Monica to get my start with boxing, we would do at least 3 rounds of shoulder, arm, body sparring, which is intense. Basically what it means is you can punch each other, shoulder, arm, body, anything below the neck, above the waist is fair game. And you have to basically, you are in a situation of fighting. You're moving, you have to move and you have to use your feints. And I mean, it really is taxing. And what he used to do is he'd tire me out. He'd get me like on the heavy bag and then get me doing a bunch of footwork drills. So I'm exhausted. Then we go into the ring and only 30 seconds between rounds. He's fresh. Okay, this is an Olympic boxer who's fresh. And we would do some shoulder body sparring. And, you know, it was one of the best workouts I've ever done. And this is before I learned how to breathe, by the way. So I would leave so oxygen wasted from those workouts, it would take me a full week to recover before the next session, really. It like really negatively affected my other workouts. And I had to kind of adjust my training plan for it because without a breathing strategy, you've got no business boxing, period, especially getting in the ring because the cardiovascular demand is so crazy, especially when you're starting to receive punches and then, you know, push on each other, lean on each other. And, you know, so it's really taxing. So 10 rounds of that. And now we're talking, you know, they might have headgear on and big, thick gloves and some body gear. But I mean, 10 rounds of sparring is a workout that would take most people 3 to 5 days to recover from. And then here's the calisthenics routine, which he still does now getting ready for fights. 200 sit-ups, 50 dips, 50 push-ups, 50 shrugs with weight. So what stands out about that? You know, I guess, you know, we went through a period when I became a trainer professionally in 2005, I was in the middle of what was, as an industry, a big revolt against anything that involved trunk flexion. Like sit-ups and crunches were bad. And I still will say, I don't think the crunch in particular, I mean, I think it has a purpose. But if we're going to talk about like best investments of time for core training, spinal health, planking and bridging, hanging, those are always going to be best. You know, these are muscles that are designed to stabilize first, move second. Or create movement second. They're designed to resist movement mainly. So, but man, you can't deny how important sit-ups seem to be to successful combat athletes. Can't deny it. So again, like you can pretend like you know everything, or you can see what people that actually are the best at what they do and take lessons and see how it works. It's a lot of pushing. It's a lot of anterior dominant work. That's interesting. I don't see any reference to Mike Tyson doing pull-ups, but he had a huge back. So a lot of that is you just have a big natural back. The shrugs obviously do. I mean, if you do shrugs properly, you really will get a big upper mid back. Not very lat intensive, but what people often overlook too with boxing is that your lats are decelerators. When you're throwing a big punches, the reason your arms don't fly out of your sockets are because your lats, the opposing muscle to, you know, the muscles that are creating, at least from an upper body standpoint, the punches, right? Chest, anterior shoulder, triceps, you know, the lats are going to be what not only decelerates the punches, but also can help you recoil, bring the hands back to your face to more, to create more exchanges or to create more punches or combinations. So I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, if you look at his physique, it looks so balanced. It doesn't look like what you would think, because a lot of bodybuilders or people that just bench press only, they start to, they just look so, I mean, this was me in my early 20s. You know, I could bench close to 400 pounds, but I couldn't do a pull-up. You know, I didn't have a lot of balance the way I do now. So that was interesting. But man, you can't deny the effectiveness of the physique it developed and the conditioning. Mid-afternoon session was more intense. Another 4 to 6 rounds of sparring. Jump rope. I'm going to, if you, I'll pop the link and you see like, he could do some like, man, 225, some of this, he was doing crazy jump rope stuff. Like, I mean, like, squatting up and down, awesome like arm trick action, you know, really cool footwork. I mean, like he looked like a middleweight, lightweight fighter with a jump rope. And then 60 minutes on the workout bike, plus another 3 rounds of calisthenics and shadow boxing. You know, that's one thing too. Two things I want to talk about. You think a lot of people now, because everything got so functional. And I'm all about function, okay? I'm all about function, but, you know, like, don't overlook the power of 60 minutes on a bike to what it can do to someone's legs. You look at cyclists, incredible quad development, incredible. And if you learn how to cycle properly, and if you really look at cycling too, it actually has a huge carryover to proper running form and technique. The problem is if you're just using your hip flexors and quads to cycle versus using hamstring to pull back and recoil in that cycle. And that's part of why right now as I'm building this walk run program and retraining my gait, I always try to finish a walk run with 10 minutes of leg cycling in the pool. I just come off the edge of it. My arms are like on the edge of the pool and then I'm just doing leg cycling. I'm just retraining my gait and trying to use all of my lower body muscles to create that cycling motion. But again, like I said, a Tyson in his prime, his legs lasted late into fights. So if you look at what he's doing in his training, yeah, there's a lot of sparring. But, I mean, 60 minutes on a workout bike, again, that's most people can't, they couldn't do it because it would be too boring or that would be all they would do for that day and they definitely weren't doing it daily. And he was doing multiple workout bike sessions in the midst of all this other stuff. So it really gives you a glimpse into what it takes to be like a true champion. But he had incredible leg development. He, like I said, could really get low and stay upright with his trunk, which is critical when you box. The more you're leaning, the more you lose your balance, and you can't not only properly throw punches or counter punch, but you have trouble defending yourself. You're just in a bad position. So he was able to avoid punches and really his legs were what separated him. He had the ability to be evasive and create incredible punching power while evading punches. So not only could he avoid getting hit, he could use his legs to generate incredible punching power. So that was really crazy. And then the early evening session, 5 more sets of calisthenics. Essentially that calisthenics routine I mentioned, he was doing that 10 times a day, every day. And more shadow box. That's something I want to touch on. People think if they don't have a bag to hit, that it's pointless to punch. If you ask any expert in boxing, anybody who's boxed, I'm telling you right now, as someone that has really committed to it and dove deep, I've made the most progress shadow boxing. With my fighting skills, shadow boxing has given me the most benefits, in a mirror, but also in the water. Because a lot of what strength training, if you come from a strength training background, you're so stiff. God, people get so stiff. You're so locked in. Everything you've been doing is so linear in a traditional strength program. You're so stiff and rigid. Your muscles are so tense that you punch and move stiff. But think about getting into the water. The water, again, it just makes a lot of sense. And if you ever do it, you'll feel the benefits instantly. Punching and doing footwork and combining footwork and punching in the water teaches you how to move fluidly. You get in fluid to learn how to become fluid. And that's been one of the biggest game changers for me. It's tough to recommend because a lot of people don't have water access. But doing boxing drills in a 3 to 5 foot pool, particularly shadow boxing, will completely change how you move in the best possible way. In particular, I love working, like I love digging hooks and uppercuts in water and having to dig my feet into the pool floor. And then I get fluid resistance throughout the full range of motion of the punches, and it'll change how you do things. So don't discount it. It might not be as I took like a 6 month break from heavy bag work as I moved and didn't have a bag to hit, but I got a new freestanding bag from Bout Bag, which is excellent. By the way, I'm working on getting a better deal for you guys. If you're interested in getting a really cool freestanding bag that has wheels that you can move, great for indoor, outdoor, and you can actually attach battle ropes and bands to it as well. And you fill it with sand and you can roll it and move it anywhere you want. So it's really cool. It is expensive, but I'm working on the discount for you. As soon as I can get it, I'll let you know. But yeah, it's great to punch something. It's kind of more fun, but at the same time, like, you'll never get as good as you can from shadow boxing. Because what it does is once you can visualize a target without being there or use yourself as a target in the mirror and really see yourself move, and then you can close your eyes and do it, then, I mean, hitting a heavy bag is just fun because you have all these skills ingrained, the muscle memory, the instinct. And then early evening, 5 more sets of calisthenics, more shadow boxing, then 30 minutes of stationary bike cardio after dinner. There was a wrap-up also that included 2,000 decline sit-ups, 500 bench dips, 500 push-ups, 500 shrugs with a 30-kilogram barbell, and 10 minutes of neck exercises. 10 minutes of neck! So old school, by the way. And I love that because, by the way, a couple things there. I don't know. I mean, like, first of all, there's no way he's doing any of these in a row without stopping. Okay, that's not possible. So I don't know how he's breaking these up. If he's doing divide and conquer, like I'm going to do 50 sit-ups, rest, 50 sit-ups, rest till I get to 2,000. Or I'm going to do, like, you know, a good way to tackle this would be, you know, 50 reps of each. Or in the case, since he's doing so many sit-ups there, let's say he does 100 sit-ups, 25 dips, 25 push-ups, 25 shrugs, and he would just repeat that circuit style until he got to those totals. Again, there's lots of ways to do that. Circuit style is going to be more of, you know, especially as you're moving to different movements, different body parts. Though again, this is more anterior dominant, but you know, sit-ups more core, obviously dip and bench is more upper body, chest, triceps, shoulders, shrugs, more traps, upper back. So again, if you're circuiting, you can keep the intensity higher and you can get it done faster. If you're going to go one move at a time, rest, pause, that's going to be more better for like a bodybuilding stimulus, and it's going to take you much longer to do because you need X amount of rest before you can kind of get back in there versus I'm fatigued, I'm going to go on to something else that allows this area to recover while I'm working the other. Again, I'm not exactly sure, but a couple things that stood out there really were lots of shrugs, man. He did lots of shrugs, and if you look at some old footage, he was huge into neck bridges. Basically getting into like a glute bridge or hip thrust, but you're on the top of your head. You basically go from like the back of your head to the top of your head, and like he's rolling and moving around. They're called wrestling or neck bridges. And you know, the thought on those now is that they're super dangerous and compressive to the cervical spine, but huge neck. Mike Tyson's neck, you know, one thing people overlook too, devastating puncher, amazing chin, but it wasn't the chin. His traps and neck were so thick and fibrous, they used to eat punches. I mean, Mike Tyson, even in the fight he lost to Buster Douglas, I mean, first of all, if we're being honest about it, he knocked Buster Douglas out in the eighth round of that fight. But it was a 13 count. And then in the subsequent rounds, Douglas knocked him out. But he hit him with an uppercut, and it was past a 10 count. The fight should have been over. Technically should have never lost that fight, but I digress. You know, I'm a true Mike Tyson fan. I've seen all the fights. And he came in out of shape, partying in Tokyo, deconditioned, and technically he still won that fight against a guy whose mom just died and realized not only was he fighting for his mom who just passed away, but you know, he was a guy that would typically come in overweight, was considered lazy. That was the one true fight he committed to, and he caught the baddest man in the world dealing with legal issues. His Robin Givens had just, they broken up. There was that whole public spat. He's dealing with, you know, one of the biggest snake oil salesmen of all time, Don King, stealing his money. He lost his trainers. I mean, it was the perfect storm. Well, 39-1 odds on that fight. And still technically won the fight. But anyway, throughout that fight, he was taking Buster 6'5", 250, 260, like this big dude hammering him in the face. And it took like 10 rounds of damage to finally knock him out. And that knockout sequence, if you see it, I mean, Tyson got like an uppercut. I mean, he got hit three times going down. Mouthpiece came out, still almost got up. His neck was huge. It would eat punches. And what that does, you know, what happens, what is a concussion? It's your brain moving around in your skull. So what's good, obviously it's not just impact there. It's when you get hit and your neck snaps. And that's what's going to help create a lot of that movement that can create concussions and brain damage. But if you have a really strong neck and traps, the punches you get hit with, your neck can stay more stationary and in place. So it's going to be able to, you end up like eating those punches. There's still plenty of damage done, but it can allow you to stay in a fight where a mere mortal gets knocked out. And one thing, by the way, I'm working on developing a new and improved neck program because it is really impressive when you have a big, chiseled, strong neck, you know, and traps. Again, a lot of trap work. So now the issue with that historically is due to much trap work, you become upper trap dominant and you tend to get prone to shoulder issues. So again, a lot of this stuff you have to choose the right exercises, some safer neck movements. And then if you're going to be doing a lot of shrugging or upper trap work, you got to make sure you do plenty of mid lower trap work that pulls those shoulder blades or scapula down and back to balance out all that elevation work. But again, it's undeniable. Anybody in contact or combat sports, big traps, thick neck, it makes a big difference. So I just saw this article and it's just like, wow. But like, it's so old school to say, just do 10 minutes of neck. And when I, in high school, shout out to Coach Don Forty, University School of Milwaukee, who was my football coach and strength coach. He got that four-way neck machine. This is actually just so funny. So it's a machine you can sit in, and it has these pads, thick pads you put your face on. You can load it with plates, and we would do four-way neck. You do 10 reps of each. So you sit in it, and you do your flexions. Then you change directions and go side flexions, left, side flexions, right. And then you do your extensions. And I mean, look, the funny thing too is like, in a given session, it'd be like 20 people working and they would just work in and everybody was like with their sweaty faces on the same thing. It was like a MRSA outbreak waiting to happen. You would put, eventually like people would learn just like put a towel, but like, you know that sweat's coming through the towel to your face. But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, I never really, I'm not sure if I had a concussion. In college, I think I had a concussion at one point and I actually had symptoms. So I actually sat out for a couple days. But I don't remember having too many concussions or headaches. But I had really thick neck and upper trap. So I think that kind of saved me because I used to use my head a lot on the field. Popping my head when I would pass rush into the lineman's face mask to get them back on their heels. Not something I'd recommend, but, and he's just using, by the way, a 30 kilogram barbell, 500 trugs. So again, there's many pathways to big, thick muscles. heavyweights can be an option, but also lighter to medium weights done to failure or to extreme volume can also, like I said, my legs were never more developed than they ever were after doing an hour of lunges or step-ups. Even more so when I was squatting 400 plus pounds. I may not have been as maximally strong bilaterally because I wasn't training that specific pattern, but I had better lower body development and it was more functional strength that would translate to a court or a field. So it is what it is. And but just, it's so old school to say 10 minutes a neck. And again, I think one of the things people overlook the most kind of in closing here, and I'll do a little Q&A if there are any questions, but I don't think there are a ton. Jordan Robinson says, I'm definitely doing it next year. I can join the local boxing gym for $40 a year. That's pretty good. Good deal. It is fun to do some sparring. And by the way, with my wife, we do it too. The shoulder body arm sparring. And, again, I can handicap it. I can, a lot of times what I'll do too is I'll work out first and then we can do it. And that way I'm already fatigued, or I'll put one arm behind my body, which is kind of insulting, but again, it's all about both of us getting a good workout. And it does make it a lot more even when all I can use my left hand. I'll do one arm both ways too, where I'll go southpaw and I'll use my right. And, I'll even tell her, the key on this is you never throw a single punch. You always have to throw a combination if you're fighting someone with one hand. But it just great cardio, great couples bonding. I felt so bad. I did hit her with a liver shot once, not super hard, but you don't need to. And she was pissed, but she's from the Bronx. She's okay. She's tough. She might cut me though. So, but just to say, I'm going to do 10 minutes of legs, 10 minutes of a single movement, that it's so old school. And again, it requires a lot of mental focus and discipline, but it is a true separator. If you're someone that still relies on someone giving you a new novel workout every single day, every time you train, I'm glad you're training, but I just hope you know that you're never going to be able to do this. This is just not for you. You're never going to find longevity in this. It brings me great joy. I hate to say this, but I guess I still need to mature a little bit. But look, I look at a company like Peloton, like the evil empire. It's a company that just has so much money behind them, and they're looking to crush all the competition now with fake patents but they peaked. They're done. I mean, they're done in terms of their peak because they got lucky with the pandemic because they had the coolest offering. They had tech, they had, the guise of community through a social media interactive platform, and now their stock is plummeting. They obviously have also had some kids died on their original treadmill model, got rolled up in it, I guess, and they had to fix it. But then they were claiming it wasn't their fault before they kind of 180 and said, no, it is, and we're going to fix this. So there's just been, questionable tactics, and, they have negatively affected a lot of the true people in this business that are actually doing good work and trying to create a lifestyle. No one's going to be on a bike for the rest of their life, getting instruction through a screen, okay? It's just not gonna happen. And I know it. Anyone in this for a long time knew it. Their stock peaked during the pandemic and now it's plummeting because people wanna go back to the gym and they don't have the discipline to do this stuff on their own or do the same thing on their own. Even if you're changing the workouts, it ends up just being a bike. It ends up being a bike to someone who doesn't have physical culture, who's not getting education, is not being empowered and given ownership of their training. And people also, they need to get out of the house. If you want to retain any essence of social skills, that's why gyms may not ever be what they used to be after this pandemic, because it ate up so many gym owners and businesses. But the ones that managed to make it through will now thrive and have shown a resilience that they'll last the test of time. And the reality is most people still need the support, accountability, and guidance from a professional in person. That's never going to change. Unless, again, pandemics become so severe that we just can't do that anymore. But I'm hopeful as someone who makes money exclusively through fitness online, I am hopeful that we can get back to some normalcy, sense of normalcy with regards to gym training. Because again, it's really just about finding what works for people to keep them going. You know, Peloton to me is just a bunch of nerds who got a lot of money and are trying to use tech to distract people from what fitness is really all about, which is learning about your body, mastering movement, and not depending on having to follow along to someone or a personality or frills and stuff to do it. And, you know, they had a good run. We'll see what happens. They're still going to, by the way, it's still going to be a major player in the game. But, you know, that's why, again, like to me, I just, I'm, if I'm not happy to see it, I'm not disappointed. Okay. I'd love for them to go away. But they won't. But it's good to see that the market's correcting itself a little bit. But by the way, I told you so. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. A couple final things on this. Stay tuned for our big Black Friday Cyber Monday sale at sleevessoldseparately.com. Our biggest deals of the year on the best men's athleisure apparel in the market. We have the best fits and the best fabrics. I'm sorry to say, we do. And I think you guys will love the deals coming there. And then I will be releasing soon my discounted offerings to the dailybj.com for 2022. We're going to have a express membership for $20 a month. Really focus on just the busy parent professional. All routines will be 20 minutes or less. And then I will be reopening a more economical, comprehensive version of the original Grillicorn Gains program. So I guess it's GG 2.0 for what would be $50 a month based on commitment level, which will be basically, it's going to be my training as I get ready for the release of my new book, which will come out in September 17th, my birthday, my 40th birthday in 2022 next year. So this is what I'm going to, I basically did this. To me, this 2021 was a rebuild. It was like, for me, year one. This was what I wish I would have given myself when I was 14, when I got started. It was a real opportunity to take 2 decades of experience, fix all of the sins of my past training in terms of, you know, restrictions, injuries, that type of stuff, build a base of mobility, stability, and breath. And now, you know, widen my base, because if you want to build a tall building, it needs a big, wide base. And now it's going to be a pretty aggressive, but you know, sound strength and muscle gain program with appropriate conditioning as well. But it's going to be exclusive routines that get me ready for the book and you know, build on what we did in 2021. Last thing I'll say too, obviously I'm taking a big break on social media, and what I'm trying to do with it now is I'm just going to post when I feel compelled to. And instead of like focusing on trying to just like get something out, I'm just going to make, if I feel like making great shit and I want to share it, I'm going to do that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a special, my annual Thanksgiving Turkey Day Damage Control workout will be released on social media. If you see it, I appreciate a like, share. It's one of those things. I've got to find a way to talk about discipline, right? I'm just too bored with, I'm too bored. I'm not into it. I can't get myself up to do it the way I need to do it to get, the marketing I need to keep this business going. So I'm trying to find a way. I'm trying to find the balance, and I guess maybe the off week can be an opportunity for me to share some stuff. Maybe I just share it once a month. I don't know, but, I'm not perfect. I currently right now lack the marketing discipline. Because it's just boring to me. So I'm trying to, maybe what I have to do is just create things that I find fun and passion, even if it's not what people are looking for. And maybe I can find new people. I don't know, but it's going to be great. I think one of them is going to be like a heavy, big workout from hell. And if I make a second thing, it'll just be one of my kind of classic Metcons that gets you a little damage control for the holidays. But my boxing heads here that have been doing the boxing work with me all year, stay tuned for my heavy, big workout from hell on social media next week. Please subscribe to the podcast. A 5-star rating and review is much appreciated. And thanks for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed this one. I'm just going to try to get back to the spirit I used to have when I got started and I was young, fresh, and focused in this space. And I hadn't had all these miles on my mind and body with it, where it's tough to kind of do the same stuff. So I know the struggle, But I'm trying to go back to the basics. And one of the things too I'm trying to find is just talk and do things I'm passionate about, because you know that's the only way I can really give you what you need. And so hopefully you guys enjoyed this episode, and I wish you a beautiful Thanksgiving. Happy holiday season. Much love. Peace.
Train like a man, sleep like a baby, train like a man, heal like a baby. Baby.
Yo, this is BJ Gador, and please use this coupon code for podcast listeners only, BabyCast15, for 15% off your next order at manbabycbd.com. That's BabyCast15, one word. Check out the show notes for more details. But I use the tincture before bed for relaxation, help me unwind, get a deep, restful sleep, and I apply the salves on sore or tender muscles and joints to help provide a deep anti-inflammatory effect and get me ready for my next workout. I think you really enjoy this. Go to manbabycbd.com, enter BabyCast15 for 15% off your next order, and thanks for listening to the podcast. Peace.